This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker in Woods Hole. It's Friday, July 30th, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Sam Houghton, Jeanette Barnes, and Daniel Ackerman. We'll speak with Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner, Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll hear from Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, and George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. CAI's Catherine Iden will speak with Mike Dean about news from the State House, and we'll talk with CAI's environment reporter, Eve Zuckoff. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. Businesses on the Outer Cape are being supplied with COVID home testing kits in an effort to combat the recent uptick in cases there. CAI's Sam Houghton has this story for us. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Steve.
Tell us about these kits. This is kind of the first that we've heard about them locally. How do they work?
Yeah, pretty neat. These are called Bionox Now test kits. They're similar to what most people are likely accustomed to with COVID tests. It's a nasal swab, but you can use these at home. They come with a QR code. That's, you know, the barcode thing for smartphones. That'll activate a website, and that'll prompt some instructions, and will actually connect you with a live proctor or agent on the other end of the phone, who will take you, you know, make sure you do the test correctly. So you take the nasal swab, you put your sample in a little card, and it'll tell you within 15 minutes if you're positive or not. And the whole process takes about 20 minutes.
So who's getting these tests, and what's the idea here for the Outer Cape?
Right. As been widely reported the last couple of weeks, this is, you know, kind of another tool to at least slow the surge in cases on the Outer Cape. So thousands of these kits have gone out to health departments in Provincetown, Truro, Wellfleet. They were distributed from Barnstable County Health Department and came from the state. The idea is that businesses, you know, restaurants, guest houses, motels, and bars, they can distribute these to their employees if there's any thought that they might be sick. So some workers, you know, think about it, they might be working for a number of different places, and there's a potential of spreading the virus from one job site to another. And of course, there's potential to spread the virus to customers. So the idea is, you know, stop the spread where you can. I spoke with the health agent in Truro, Emily Beebe. She says that the real, you know, best way to slow this surge is wearing masks and getting vaccinated if people haven't already. But these kits will be a big help. Also important to say that these are available for free. If you're a business in Wellfleet, Truro, and Provincetown, call up the local health department, and they'll get you these kits.
How interesting that we're this far into the pandemic and seeing this new tool come forward. We're going to talk more about the Provincetown cluster itself in just a few minutes. But briefly, Sam, this is really an initiative to address a COVID uptick that's attributed to the Delta variant, right?
Yeah, right. The Delta variant that was confirmed on the Cape over the weekend at Martha's Vineyard last week. The cluster associated with Provincetown keeps growing. But they're seeing these cases also rise in Wellfleet and Truro. That's likely connected to that Provincetown surge. In Wellfleet, they saw about 12 cases. Half of those were from folks that worked in Provincetown. But other towns are seeing a small rise as well, a lot in vaccinated people also. And health agents are saying, yes, this, you know, this is directly tied to the Delta variant. And we've seen some towns issue new masking guidance. Wellfleet is recommending the businesses require masks inside their establishment. Truro has a similar advisory in place. But still, you know, the big message we hear from health officials is, you know, wear your mask, but get vaccinated if you haven't. There are breakthrough cases with the Delta variant, as we've seen, but the cases are milder for folks who have been vaccinated, and that's what we're hearing locally.
That's CAI Sam Houghton. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you.
The recent COVID surge in Provincetown raised questions about the vulnerability of people on HIV-suppressing drugs. CAI's Jeanette Barnes reported that story this week and joins us now. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
Jeanette, you talked with folks at the AIDS Support Group of Cape Cod. What did they tell you?
Right. Well, I talked to Dan Gates, the CEO, and he said there's been some recent research showing that people living with HIV who contract COVID-19 are more likely to get seriously ill or die from it. Now, the good news is, he says, they may actually not be any more likely to get COVID-19, though, than the average person. And that's because if a person with HIV is taking antiretroviral medication, their immune system is often very strong. So that helps a lot. He said he's talked to some people in Provincetown, and so far he's not aware of anyone with HIV who's part of the outbreak there.
Hmm. And Gates did draw a line between people living with HIV and the COVID vaccine. That was interesting.
Yes, right. He said, first of all, he saw very little vaccine hesitancy among his clients, and he feels like they really know the value of vaccines because they've been waiting to see one for HIV for so long, 40 years, actually.
Hmm. You also reported this week on progress toward decommissioning the former nuclear power station in Plymouth, the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant there. Bring us up to date on what's happening there.
Yes, so the owner of the plant, Holtec, has started loading the last batch of the spent nuclear fuel assemblies from the plant into these huge concrete drums, which are called casks. These are the last 34 of what is expected to be 61 casks total on the site in Plymouth there, which is actually on the plant property. But what's new next week is they plan to start moving the casks that are already on a dry storage pad at Pilgrim up to a higher elevation. The new spot is 75 feet above sea level, as opposed to 25 feet where they were before. And that's something that local activists have pushed for, to protect from storm damage and rising sea level, really, as a safety thing. So the material in the casks, of course, is radioactive waste. So you can see why they might be concerned about that. Someone from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission at the federal level is scheduled to be on the site next week to observe a dry run of the special equipment that they need to move the casks. It's, you know, special equipment, because they are 150 tons each one. But they, yeah, after that dry run, they will be moving them upland.
150 tons is a lot of weight to move. CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Thanks, Jeanette.
Thanks.
A labor shortage continues to be felt across our region. Earlier, I spoke with CAI South Coast reporter Daniel Ackerman about impacts on the South Coast. Here's our conversation. Hi, Daniel.
Hey, Steve.
So you met some frustrated business owners this week. What did you hear from them?
Well, they cannot find anyone to work. This is a problem that's been going on for months now. You know, we've heard about it in the tourism and hospitality industry, which of course is really big in the region this time of year. But the labor shortage really seems to be hitting businesses of all stripes. I talked this week with Ryan Pereira. He's a sales manager at Precision Window and Kitchen, which is a construction and supplier and contractor in New Bedford. And he told me that customer demand right now is higher than it's ever been. So like, this could be his business's most profitable year ever. But instead, he's turning customers away because he just doesn't have the staff. In total, Pereira said his company, it's a family business, they have 7 employees, and he would like to maybe double that number, but they just can't even find a single new hire to bring on at this point. He told me that he's asked a bunch of potential workers in for a job interview, but no one has showed up so far. And he said pretty much if anyone so much as actually arrives for their scheduled interview, he would offer them a job on the spot.
So how big a problem is this across the South Coast?
It seems to be pretty widespread. I asked Rick Kidder about this, and he heads the One South Coast Chamber, which is the Chamber of Commerce for the region. He said pretty much every business he works with is feeling this labor squeeze. And Kidder laid out 3 main factors that he thinks are at play here. First, there's obviously the pandemic, especially with the spread of the Delta variant. He thinks some people are hesitant to go back into a workplace that might potentially expose them to the virus. Then also, one of the industries that is experiencing a labor shortage is childcare. You know, it's really expensive, really hard to come by childcare, so that is also keeping a lot of potential working parents at home. And then third, Kidder suspects that the boost to federal unemployment benefits could be allowing some potential workers to stay out of the labor force for a little longer than they otherwise might. Now, those benefits expire in September, so We'll see if there's any change then. But for now, Kidder said, you know, the businesses he works with are trying all types of things. They're raising wages. They're offering signing bonuses. They're offering bonuses to recruit your friends and family to come work. But so far, the labor shortage just does not seem to be easing.
Hey, let's talk about wastewater, which is always a big topic in our region. You reported this week on a new treatment plant in Buzzards Bay. Tell us about the new plant there.
Yeah, so the town of Bourne has been building this new plant in Buzzards Bay for a few years now. The plant comes with a price tag of $10 million, and that is coming from a mix of state money, and then there's also going to be an increase in residents' sewer bills to help pay it off. But the construction on the plant is now complete. I visited it yesterday. It looks nice and shiny. All the pipes and pumps seem to be working. It's passed all of its tests. And last week, the Department of Environmental Protection gave the plant its authorization, and it should start operating next month.
And how is this new wastewater plant expected to impact life in Buzzards Bay?
Well, it's going to allow for a lot of new development. That's what the town administrator, Tony Schiavi, told me while he was giving me the tour of the plant yesterday. And he said that previously, Buzzards Bay had sent all of its sewage next door to Wareham. So Wareham had agreed to take up to 200,000 gallons of Buzzards Bay sewage. And Schiavi said that that cap meant that Buzzards Bay couldn't build out more large developments that might need a sewer connection. So having this additional treatment capacity right in Buzzards Bay means that new apartment units and hotels and restaurants, they can all come in and tie right into the new treatment plant in Buzzards Bay. So this plant can treat up to 100,000 gallons of wastewater per day, and Schiavi said he hopes that will spark new investment and new development in the village.
That's CAI South Coast reporter Daniel Ackerman. Daniel, thanks.
Yeah, good to be here.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll talk about the latest on the Provincetown cluster with Marianne Bragg of the Provincetown Banner. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. Provincetown has been coping with a COVID spike that has prompted town officials to approve an indoor mask mandate. Marianne Bragg of the Provincetown Banner has the latest for us and joins us now. Hi, Marianne.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. Marianne, where are we at right now with the numbers? This week they really jumped up, but there's a caution here that these numbers are cumulative, right?
Well, that's right. And in a very good way, the town manager is posting daily updates on Facebook to let the townspeople, community know what the numbers are. But so this kind of one number, which is that cumulative number that's nearing close to 900 positive confirmed COVID virus cases. And it's important to note that some of those have since fallen off and are, you know, considered out of isolation and no longer at risk. But so there's kind of this cumulative number that town leaders are looking at. There's also, as a way to gauge just kind of the direction of the virus, they're really encouraging and offering free COVID testing at a community center. And so there's also that what we call the positivity rate, so a test positivity rate. That's another number that's being watched right now. And kind of at the highest, like 15% of people who showed up for a free test tested positive for COVID. And now, you know, a week later, they're down to about 7%. And the goal for town officials is to for them to lift this indoor mask mandate. They need to get under 3% for 5 days in a row. Mm. So that's, we're kind of watching, everybody's watching those two numbers to see how it's going.
Tell us about this indoor mask mandate. What does it call for, and how are businesses coping with it?
Well, I mean, it's literally, you're walking around the street, you might be, you know, a visitor, and you, you know, outdoors, you're free to you know, kind of walk without masks. But as soon as you walk inside, you know, a business or a publicly owned building, then you need to have a mask on. And there are, you know, various exceptions based on what you're doing inside, you know, this particular, the business where you are or the office. And so it's, you know, something like, you know, even if you're like at a gym, you still have to keep your mask on, even if you're really exercising really vigorously. Like in a dance bar or like a dance club, you can take your mask off if you're like seated at a bar seat or seated at a table. But if you're dancing, just as an example, you have to keep your mask on. So there's kind of all these nuanced kind of that I'm sure that business owners are having to kind of keep an eye on.
What's the energy like right now in the town? Are people seem to be very aware of this going on, and people up and down Commercial Street wearing masks or pretty much not outside?
I would say not so much outside, actually.
Mm-hmm.
As a person who lives here, I would say it's definitely like, well, I'm not sure, you know, I want to go out and eat at a restaurant or, you know, go inside so much right now. We're all kind of pulling out our masks that we had tucked away, you know, earlier this summer. I think it definitely on the street, you don't see many people wearing masks. And the streets seem to be pretty decently full too as well. So it doesn't seem like it's totally depressed, you know, visitor populations.
Is there a sense that there's plenty of testing available now for folks?
Oh, yeah. So, right. I think, you know, I was looking like Wednesday, they tested like 353 people at this free, it's a free testing. It's kind of a walk-up, no appointment, no insurance required. People who were, we had visited there earlier in the week, the testing site, and you know, the three people we spoke to, they generally had kind of a, you know, were having a good experience. Like they weren't standing in line for hours. And it's actually a PCR test, which is, you know, as of course, you know, the best, you know, the best test you can get. So I would feel free to go there myself. It seems like it's a very good experience and people are able to kind of get through the test pretty easily.
That is Marianne Bragg of the Provincetown Banner joining us to talk about the Provincetown COVID spike. Marianne, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
On Martha's Vineyard, a new nursing home facility may be a step closer to becoming a reality. Noah Asimov, the Vineyard Gazette, has this one. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Steve.
Noah, this is still early days for this. What we're really talking about here is a purchase of land that could be developed for a nursing home that would replace the island's existing one. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The hospital, earlier this week, they closed on a 26-acre property off the Vineyard Haven Edgartown Road. Essentially, the hospital's goal is to replace its current Windermere long-term care nursing facility, which is an annex to the hospital currently on their Oak Bluff site. According to the hospital officials and what they've said in public meetings, the Windermere Nursing Facility has been sort of just bleeding money for a long time. It's not financially stable, and it has a declining census. And so the hospital is interested in constructing a new nursing facility, but there are a lot of hurdles that remain. And the property purchase was made for $3.6 million, and the sellers are the Norton family, who bought a lot of property in Edgartown, actually recently sold a property to the Boys and Girls Club for a facility there as well.
Tell us about this property itself, how big, and what's the scope of what they're proposing there?
Yeah, so the property is 26 acres. It's a pretty large property. The project is, at least the project that the hospital has talked about, is expected to cost about $34 million. Essentially what they want to do is build a greenhouse. It's called a greenhouse elder home model. That's essentially the difference is instead of having a nursing facility inside a hospital, so people are living in what are sort of more dorm-style hospital rooms, they would be independent clustered houses that would have live-in care, sort of common spaces, open kitchen design. There are about 300 greenhouse facilities across the country, and the hospital's partnered with a contractor and developer that is certified to build this sort of facility. And it would be 70 beds. There would be sort of five 14-bed houses clustered around a garden space. And then there would also be 60 beds of workforce housing for hospital staff. Mm. So it is a fairly large development relative to the size of the vineyard. I think the current Windermere census is below 50 right now. So it would at least increase it by 20. But a big difference here is that actually the hospital is hoping to restrict only about half its beds to Medicare and Medicaid residents, with the hope that the other half could be private pay, because that's one of the reasons that they need the new facility. It's financial.
And one of the big hurdles here, it looks like they're going to have to get over, has to do with wastewater.
Yeah, exactly. Wastewater is sort of the thing that's looming over most development projects here, but this one is particularly complicated. Essentially, what's going to have to happen is the hospital wants to tie into town sewer, but to do so, they're going to have to upgrade pumping stations in between where the facility would be and the town sewage plant. They're also going to have to get easement through a group of properties to be able to connect to town sewer. And according to the town's contractor, those are going to cost in the million, or at least over $1 million. And it's going to force the town to undertake what's called a comprehensive wastewater management program. I know it kind of sounds like jargon, but it's a big deal. It's what happens when the town reaches 80% of its daily flow sewer capacity. The state requires you to undertake sort of more long-term planning about the sewer plant. And just speaking to the wastewater facility manager, he called it sort of a liminal moment, meaning that the town is on the threshold of needing to expand its sewer capacity, or at least plan more creatively about its future with regard to it.
Noah Asmo of the Vineyard Gazette, I'm sure, will be speaking again about this project as it moves forward. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
In Orleans, some residents are upset about outdoor enthusiasts trespassing across private property, particularly as people visit conservation lands. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us with this story. Hi, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, this seems to be an issue that's getting worse for residents as more and more people are taking advantage of getting outdoors and visiting public areas.
Yeah, it seems to have been exacerbated by just the fact that, as you said, more people are around now, you know, after lockdown and the pandemic, people want to get outside. People in Orleans who live around those conservation areas and particularly town landings that provide access to the beach are complaining to town officials that they're just seeing people trespassing on private property, clogging side streets with parked cars, you know, causing environmental damage to the pathways and coastal banks. One resident at the Weisset Point area said he counted some 12,000 people crossing his property and using the neighborhood to access from the end of Tonset Road to Orleans Conservation Trust property. Publicity about the trails that are maintained in these areas, particularly by the Orleans Conservation Trust, and really a lack of signs delineating the boundaries of the town landings are part of the problem, the neighbors say. Also, overlapping jurisdiction between the Select Board and the Conservation Commission is another issue. The two groups met last week to discuss this, and they agreed that there really has to be a better job done educating the public about where public property ends and private property begins, as well as, you know, the fact that in Massachusetts, the public doesn't have the right to access private beaches, which, of course, isn't the case in most other states, but in Massachusetts, that is the situation. Select Board member Kevin Galligan said while the town has spent a lot of money, you know, buying open space and preserving land, it hasn't really devoted the resources it should be doing to maintaining those properties and, you know, providing education about what's allowed there and what's not. And town officials, they've also agreed that this is a problem that's really not unique to Orleans. And it's kind of, an aspect of the whole region being a little overburdened in many ways with too many people, with too much just too much activity and not enough land. And the select board has asked town administrator John Kelly to work with staff to draft an action plan in order to create maybe a working group or some sort of body to further consider the problem and maybe draft some recommendations.
Let me ask you about another story you have real briefly. The Monomoy Theater last had performances in 2018. The property was sold. There's been an effort to revive the theater, but nothing has come of that yet. But the theater is hosting a performance this summer, a performance of a type, and it's a kind of a thank you to fans and supporters. Tell us about this particular performance.
Yeah, that's exactly it. The a number of alumni from the theater, as well as the friends of the Monomoy Theater Group, they've organized this one-time-only production of The Secret Garden, which will happen August 10th, 11th, and 12th at St. Christopher's Church in downtown Chatham. And as you said, Steve, it's a way for them to sort of thank the community for supporting the theater over six decades. And while we don't know when or if Monomoy Theater will ever return, these folks that include Alan Rust, who was the longtime artistic director of the theater, they just feel that they'd like to get out into the community and thank the town for supporting them. Tickets for this, it's a staged reading of The Secret Garden. Tickets are going to be free, but reservations are required because seating is limited, and you can get info on where to get those tickets on our website, CapeCodChronicle.com.
Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
Breakthrough COVID cases and the presence of the Delta variant are a big topic of conversation on Nantucket. Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror has the latest from the island. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, what is the COVID situation looking like right now?
Right now, Nantucket Cottage Hospital is estimating that about two-thirds of the recent COVID cases here on the island are breakthrough cases, which means obviously that the person testing positive for COVID has been fully vaccinated. There have been just over 80 cases reported in the past 2 weeks. That's among the larger incidences around the state these days. And town public health officials believe that upswing is most likely caused by the Delta variant. There have just been two Delta variant cases confirmed on the island yesterday. It takes a little while for those cases to be tested. Once the positive test comes in, it has to be sent back off again to be tested for the Delta variant. And of all the cases that have gone out, two have just come back with the Delta variant. Health officials stressed, however, that the recent cases are much milder within the vaccinated population, and Nantucket has a fairly sizable vaccinated population among the highest in the state. There haven't been any hospitalizations due to coronavirus in the last 2 weeks, and only one person has been transferred off-island for a higher level of care during that period. There were eight new positive tests reported yesterday afternoon out of a total of 153 tests, and the hospital's seven-day positivity rate is around 15%, which is relatively on the high side, but in recent days it's down to around 5 or 6%. And the town continues to do its wastewater analysis, and the most recent collection on July 26th estimates that moving forward we're looking at a rate of about 10 cases per day, and that's holding steady from the last collection, the last sampling taken on July 22nd. Health Director Roberto Santamaria said he has no plans at this point anyway to recommend a mask mandate or any capacity limitations on island businesses, although town officials did issue a mask advisory last week asking everyone, regardless of vaccination status, to wear masks in public spaces indoors and out.
Mm. You have an interesting story this week about police and fire chiefs concerned about the return of big events. They say they don't have the manpower to effectively police them. Folks on the island concerned about what that could mean.
They are, and it's an evolving story. Police Chief Bill Pittman and Fire Chief Steve Murphy said this week that manpower shortages in both of their departments and increasingly large crowds at some of Nantucket's longstanding big events like the Boston Pops concert at Jetty's Beach that benefits the hospital, the town's Main Street 4th of July festivities that include a massive water fight between upwards of 1,000 people in the fire department, and even smaller events but more concentrated events like the Nantucket Wine Festival are becoming a burden on public safety. The lack of manpower, Police Chief Bill Pittman said in particular, at what can be alcohol-fueled events, increases the odds that his officers and the attendees will be put in untenable situations. A town bylaw requires one police officer for every 200 people at an event where alcohol is served, and for an event like the Boston Pops, which draws 8,000 people to the beach, that's 40 police officers. He doesn't even have that many. He'd have to call in summer specials. Even in, you know, in non-COVID years, that's a lot. He said the end goal, obviously, in the eyes of public safety, is having these larger events perhaps broken up into smaller, more manageable ones. And Fire Chief Steve Murphy echoes the same sentiments. He has a much smaller department than even the police department. In a single event like the Pops or the Main Street Water Fight, something like that, can really occupy upwards of a third of his entire department at one time, which makes it more difficult to respond to all the other activity that's going on the island in a busy summer day.
Mm. Hey, I can't let you go without asking you about this story about this long-distance paddleboarder who reached the island on Tuesday. He reached the island after a 24-day journey on his paddleboard.
He did. This is my favorite story of the summer so far. long-distance paddle, something I could never do. Long-distance paddleboarder Adam Nagler arrived on Nantucket around 6:30 on Tuesday night. And again, it was after 450 miles and 224 days on the water. He left the Chesapeake Bay in Virginia almost a month ago. He battled rip currents. He was escorted to shore in New Jersey by the police, who thought he was either in distress or doing something he shouldn't have been out on the water. And he saw more than a dozen sharks in a 24-hour period. He also lost 30 pounds. He did the whole thing as a benefit to raise money for Nantucket's Fairwinds Counseling Center. And as of yesterday afternoon, he'd raised more than $70,000. Mm. Congratulations and good work by him.
Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we're going to speak with George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on the Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. On Martha's Vineyard, a 9-year-old boy received a hero's welcome as he returned to the island from a stay at Boston Children's Hospital. George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times has this story, and it's a good one. Hi, George.
Hey, Steve. How are you? This is a great story, and happy to have been able to have our intern, Nicholas Rudderman, report this story. Keyshawn was injured earlier this month in a pretty horrific accident. A pickup truck hit him in Aquinnah, dragged him for about 20 feet. He was trapped underneath it for a bit. Some Good Samaritans jacked up the pickup truck to get him out from underneath it, and emergency services folks got there and transported him to the hospital. He was airlifted to Children's Hospital. He made a triumphant return on Wednesday afternoon back to the island, was greeted by dozens of people.
You have a great video of this, and he looks a little bit stunned by the greeting he's receiving, I have to say.
Yeah, he was a bit stunned. You know, this was all a surprise for him coming back to the island, and it was great. You know, this happens when sports teams come back from the island. The emergency responders love to get the trucks and the cars out and honk the, run the sirens, and it's just great. And people were chanting his name, and the Sharks baseball team, which is collegiate players, really rallied around Keyshawn. He's a big baseball fan, and they learned of that. Some of them went and visited him at the hospital, and they've just been a great supporter of his and working on his efforts to get better. And this is just, like I said, a great story, and happy that it had this outcome.
Mm.
We weren't talking about something more tragic.
Describing, we say it's a good story because this boy is home standing and smiling and on the mend, but it starts with this terrible accident. It's amazing that he's come through like this. And also, there's a whole aspect of community support here. There's a GoFundMe campaign to help the family figure out. He's obviously not done with his recovery yet.
Yeah, and I can't say I'm surprised by the Vineyard anymore. This community, every time there's something like this, they rally support around the individual and the individual's family, and it's just so heartening to see time and time again. Just a great community we live in here.
The story of Keyshawn Devine, and you can find it in the Martha's Vineyard Times. That's George Brennan. Thanks for talking with us, George.
Absolutely. Take care.
State officials heard from labor unions and other progressive groups this week about how to spend $5 billion in federal relief money. State education officials also talked about how they plan to get COVID vaccines to children under the age of 12. Once the FDA approves a vaccine for that age group, CAI's Catherine Ident talked with our State House reporter Mike Dean about these stories and more. Here's their conversation.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Catherine.
So the school year is not that far away already, it seems, and state officials are considering how they might offer a COVID vaccine to kids under the age of 12 when it gets approval from the FDA.
Yeah, well, a lot of the state's plan resembles programs and plans that are already in sight for vaccinating children over 12 years. So back when 16-year-olds were eligible for the vaccine, they started getting these kind of pop-up vaccination clinics in high schools that expanded to middle schools when the age dropped to 12. Now, if more and more children, if elementary school-age kids are going to come into the system, that's kind of what we're looking at, is an expansion of this in-school vaccination clinic that districts have been instructed on how to apply to the state to get one of those up and running in their school district come the fall. Another big part of the plan the state has is to rely on, you know, trusted pediatricians, obviously, children's caregivers to begin with, and also a number of the vaccination clinics through pharmacies and established places that we've seen throughout the pandemic. One thing that Baker and Health and Human Services Secretary Mary Lou Sutters emphasizes, that they're not going to open up mass vaccination sites for children. Between the pharmacies, pediatricians, and in their local schools, they think there should be enough resources to get the vaccines out, because we aren't looking at shortages the way that we did when those older age groups were coming online earlier this year.
In other news, we've talked about this before, Mike. State lawmakers have decided they want to take their time considering what to do with $5 billion in federal money. They did, though, have a hearing this week to start to get some feedback from the public.
Yeah, so we've been hearing over and over again from Governor Baker and from members of his administration about what the governor wants to do to spend this $5 billion. And if you'll remember, the legislature moved pretty swiftly to strip Baker of his authority to spend it. So now he has to go through the permission and get permission from the legislature in order to do it. They are taking a very, very slow walk on how to spend this $5 billion. They are now holding hearings, they are talking to people, and they plan to have some kind of spending plan in place by the fall, at least that's what they say. So this was the second of a number of hearings that the Ways and Means and Revenue Committees have been holding. And not only did they hear from Baker's cabinet again, but they also heard from a lot of folks from outside, from labor unions and kind of liberal allies of the Democratic legislature, who are sometimes saying similar things to the way Baker wants to spend the money, but also saying that more money needs to be put up front to those low-wage workers who suffered the most through the pandemic. One idea they want to have is retroactive hazard pay for low-wage workers who were on the front lines of the pandemic throughout last year and earlier this year. Another idea is to have a state version of what is now the federal child tax credit. So that would be an additional $600 per children from state tax money. And there's, you know, a laundry list of wants that groups from the left want to see the Democratic legislature put the money into, things like the MBTA, greater home care spending, things like that. So this is kind of the issue that the legislature is looking at right now. They want to spend it wisely, but they also want to appease their constituents. And a lot of their constituents are these, more liberal and labor groups that want to see the money go in specific places.
And finally, Mike, I want you to get out your crystal ball. Governor Charlie Baker and State Attorney General Mara Healey, they're considering running for governor next year, but neither one has officially declared a candidacy. Meanwhile, we've talked about some other candidates that have jumped into the race. So what about Baker and Healey? Will we see them announce anything soon?
Right. They are the two big feet in the room right now when it comes to the gubernatorial contest that we're going to see next year. Neither Baker or Healey really have much to lose by not declaring a candidacy immediately, really even within this calendar year. We'll be a year out from this election in November of this year. So there is definitely time. but it's the biggest name Democrat and the biggest name Republican. They're both staying noncommittal. So in the meantime, that does mean that at least some kind of activist and volunteer energy, and especially a lot of donations, will go to some of the declared opponents, the candidates who have already said they're running. So there are a handful of lesser-known Democrats and at least one Republican who can kind of scoop up what they can in the meantime, and that is important on a fundraising level. You know, so whenever we ask Baker, he says that he and Lieutenant Governor Karen Polito, they're still thinking about a third term. Republican operatives and others that I talk to around Beacon Hill, they tell me that there's really no harm in him waiting because he is, you know, the incumbent governor. He can come in and turn on the taps for fundraising whenever he feels like it. Healy said on GBH's Boston Public Radio earlier this month that she's probably going to decide in the fall. She is raising a decent amount of money right now, and talk is persistent among those people that she's talking to for that money that she is, in fact, gearing up to take the plunge. Whether Baker is in the race or not, and that's an important factor. I wrote this week about how they seem to be playing campaign chicken, waiting for one to blink first, you know, to step out into the campaign before the other. There's a number of other Democrats in the race. There's Jeff Deal on the Republican side challenging Baker, but we really still are looking at what is Baker going to do and what is Healy going to do, and will their decisions be kind of mutually impactful on the others? But again, we got time, and so we'll see how this shapes up in the fall.
And that is CAI State House reporter Mike Dean talking with us, as he does most weeks, from Beacon Hill. Mike, thanks a lot.
Oh, always great to be with you, Catherine.
And CAI's Catherine Iden speaking there with Mike Dean. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. Air quality has been up and down over the last week from the coast to the islands. CAI's environment reporter Eve Zukoff has the latest on what's happening. She joins us now. Hi, Eve.
Hey there, Steve.
Eve, we've all been looking at these hazy skies over the last kind of few weeks. What's going on here?
Yeah, okay. So what's going on here is that prevailing winds are pushing wildfire smoke from the west out to here on the East Coast. Around 80 wildfires have been burning across almost 1.5 million acres in 12 states in the U.S. That's probably increasing as we speak. And we've seen things change a lot, right? So air quality has ranged here kind of from the Cape Coast and Islands angle from perfectly fine. Right now, we have good air quality in the region to unhealthy for sensitive groups. So it doesn't mean the situation is moving. These fires are continuing, and actually one step further, not only are they continuing just right now, but there's pretty good evidence that climate change is causing these extreme heat events and really intense droughts that are making fires worse than they otherwise be. So we could, for the next couple of weeks, have some days of poor air quality.
What are public health officials recommending to keep people safe if that happens?
Yeah, so for the most part, officials are saying that people in sensitive groups, that's people with asthma or lung disease, heart disease, when air quality is worse, they should reduce prolonged activity or heavy outdoor exertion, take more breaks, do less intense activities, follow asthma action plans. These things are really important. But also, there could come a point, and we've seen this more in the greater Boston area, but it doesn't mean we won't see it here, where when air quality really becomes impaired, not just for sensitive groups, but for the general public, people should really think about bringing their plans inside. It's just not really healthy air to breathe right now, because the particulates from that smoke can get trapped in our lungs and trigger all kinds of health problems.
Hey, this week you also reported the town of Falmouth has scheduled a public hearing to allow Falmouth residents to share their thoughts on a proposed machine gun range at Joint Base Cape Cod. But that meeting was set before the town confirmed that base officials could even attend, which seems a little unusual. What's going on there?
Yeah. Okay. So this meeting, it's been tentatively set for Thursday, August 26th. It's about a month from now at 6 p.m. at Falmouth High School. And first, I'll just say the meeting is expected to be an opportunity for residents to share their thoughts with state lawmakers and the select board before the select board takes a formal position on the proposed range. We've seen a bunch of groups take formal positions, and they're mostly in opposition. The town of Mashpee has, Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe has, Barnstable Commission has. So we're seeing a lot of opposition. And part of the way that this happened, that the select board kind of took a little bit of a bold move here to say, we're moving forward, whether you're there or not. It's just that the way that one select board described it to me is that the frustration has become uncorked. There's been this feeling among many local elected officials and informed public that the Guard has not been entirely forthcoming about their plans for this proposed machine gun range. They feel like, we've asked questions, we didn't know that this was in the works for 10 years. We gotta move forward. And you know, the frustration is becoming really palpable. I think that's where this story has moved.
So the Guard hasn't committed yet to come to this meeting. Do we know what they're gonna do? Will they show up?
No, we haven't yet heard from them. And really it will be on them. I mean, the Falmouth Select Board is saying, we do hope that the National Guard will come. This was not a move to say, like, you know, don't come. It was to say, like, we had to get this on the books, but we want them to come, do a presentation, and be open and listen to the concerns that people have.
I want to talk to you about another story, too, here, and this is very new, but new research is finding that North Atlantic right whales are increasingly using the offshore wind development areas in New England. Start by telling us about the research. What do we know about it?
Yeah, okay. So what we know about this research is that about 23% of North Atlantic right whales can be seen in the Vineyard Wind development area over the last couple of years, about 23% of the population. We did not know that before today. I think before today, what we knew is that right whales really spend kind of the late winter to early spring time in this area, these critically endangered species. They like eating and, you know, hanging out with their whale pals here. That's kind of what we see. This new research shows that they're here year round, even though the numbers are smaller certain months from 2017 to today. They're here all the time. And that's really significant research for a project that has really been has moved forward with all kinds of federal permits that say, you know, we can have pile driving and we can have noise during the construction period. And just 2 weeks ago, the federal government awarded Vineyard Wind a marine mammal harassment permit before we knew that they were here. So I think this research is raising a lot of really important questions about how much more we will know about right whales when it could be too late, when development is already well underway.
So this whole area that has been set aside for offshore wind development, it turns out that these whales are in this area a lot more than had previously been documented. How damaging could this be for the offshore wind development as it's moving forward?
You know, I don't think we know the answer to that question yet. I think it really depends on how conservation groups will seize onto this information. I think that one thing we have heard in the past is that, you know, conservation groups want to see offshore wind. I mean, it's incredibly clean, kind of power. It's the right, you know, kind of transition. That's what conservationists say. But at the same time, they don't want to see it at the loss of a critically endangered species. So I think it's really going to depend on how people seize on this information. We don't yet know whether it could derail Vineyard Wind, but I think it could certainly lead to calls for a lot more survey efforts, a lot more attention to whether right whales are going to be in the area during construction. I know Vineyard Wind has made lots of promises to make sure that they protect right whales during the construction period, but there are questions about noise. There are questions about whether currents could change and that could disrupt the with the turbines in the area, and that could disrupt their food source. There's just a lot of big questions before I think we know what the next step is in a story like this.
That is CAI's environment reporter Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thanks.
Thanks, Eve.
That's our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Sam Houghton and Jeanette Barnes and Daniel Ackerman. We spoke with Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner, Noah Asimo of the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, and Josh Bolling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We heard from George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and CAI's Catherine Iden spoke with Mike Dean about news from the State House, and of course, CAI's environment reporter Eve Zuckoff. Big thanks to Dan Treidel for engineering the program, flipping the switches that make it all happen and happen real nice. Thanks, Dan. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.